Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
Day four of the Joseph Banas murder trial, and prosecutors are still in charge, but it is the defense that was digging in today. Eric King has been covering the trial since the opening day. He's live at the Judicial Center with the very latest. Eric?
Yeah, today the defense team is really digging in its heels, trying to prove that Joseph Banas is the only person who has continually told the truth, the whole truth, about that night in December of 2009 that left 37-year-old James Carroll dead. The defense says it was Joseph Banas who was first to talk to police in June of 2010, telling them there was a body buried in the basement of the home he shared with his boyfriend, Jeffrey Munt, and identifying it as James Carroll. Banas says Munt is the killer. Munt blames Banas. The defense hammered in on homicide detective Colin King, trying to paint Munt as the one consistently not telling the truth. Police say initially Munt claimed he had no idea who the victim was. But then
he kind of slipped up. We caught him on it. He said Jamie or something along those lines.
That's right. And, you remember that?
Yes, sir.
Exactly what happened.
The defense presses.
Even when you get back here after he has told you that he knew more about it, he continues to lie to you, doesn't he?
Yes, sir.
And we know that because we know darn well that he knew the guy's name, right?
Well, we didn't until he slipped up and
said it.
Complicating the case even more for jurors, clips of the original police interviews where Banas and Munt tell different versions of the same story.
I didn't do it. I didn't want to be part of this whole thing. But he came upstairs and he said that I would get my down there and help him, or else I'd be going into that hole with Jamie.
The insistence that the hole be dug larger, because that was the hole that was reserved for me.
If you are one of the many who has been following us on Twitter as we've been live tweeting this case, you know this now sets us up for the prosecution's main event. We're expecting Jeffrey Munt himself to be on the stand as early as Monday. We're live downtown. I'm Eric King, WLKY News.
Hello and welcome to episode 206 of Who Killed? I am your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media Evergreen Podcast and Killer Podcast production. On this week's episode, I have a very prolific author and historian joining me to discuss his latest book, and that is one David Domine. And welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking time out of your crazy schedule to join me and to discuss this latest book. Now, you are an author and historian. Could you give us a little brief overview about what it is that you cover and have covered in the past, and then what the book is about?
Yeah, so I am based in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm not from Louisville originally. I'm from Wisconsin. I ended up here in the 1990s. My plan was to do some time at grad school and get out of town. I had no desire to come to Louisville, Kentucky. I'd never been here before. But I ended up falling in love with the city, and I stayed. I've stayed in the city, like spent half my life here, so it's my new hometown. But there is a part of town called Old Louisville. It's one of the largest historic preservation districts in the United States. There's 45 square blocks of old houses, roughly 1,400 old homes and mansions, and so that's where I lived when I first moved here. And I just fell in love with the neighborhood and all these great Victorian houses, and then. I started hearing stories. People started sharing stories and legends about the neighborhood. And in 1999, I actually bought a Victorian house on 3rd Street, which was kind of the old Millionaire's Row part of town. My house was a small house by old Louisville standards. It was only about 4,000 square feet, had 6 bedrooms. A typical house in old Louisville is like 6,000 square feet, has 8-10 bedrooms.
Wow.
And I moved in November of 1999, and right before I moved in, the previous owner just casually mentioned that I'd be getting a ghost that came with the house. And I love ghost stories. I've always been fascinated by the paranormal, but I don't really believe in ghosts, and so I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and signed the contract and moved in. And within 2 or 3 weeks, all these crazy things began happening in the house that she said what happened. She said there was a poltergeist named Lucy who liked to walk up and down the hallway on the second floor in the middle of the night. And sure enough, within 2-3 weeks, we began hearing footsteps going up and down the length of the hallway, always like between 3 and 4 in the morning. And, you know, I discovered old houses make a lot of noise, but these weren't like random creaks and groans. They were like footsteps. And my cats and dogs started acting crazy, like Margaret, the previous owner, said they would. And the last thing she told me was, she says, I know you don't believe me, Dave, but whatever you do, don't hang a picture on the wall here in the butler's pantry next to the kitchen, because Lucy, the ghost, she hates when you hang pictures on this wall. If you hang a picture here, I guarantee you she'll knock it down. Well, I moved in, and what's the first thing I did? I hung a picture on that wall, and by the end of the day, it was on the floor. It was broken. We never could have a picture on that wall.
I have to ask, did you do it on purpose, just to test? Or well, did you just forget about it?
No, I didn't believe her, you know?
Oh, okay.
I didn't even think about it. Yeah, I didn't take it seriously. And then the first time it fell, all of a sudden I remembered what she said, and, you know. But long story short, I never saw the ghost I was hoping to see, you know, something that would make me a believer. But I did have all these things happen that were paranormal in nature. And so that first year in the house, that's when I began to make friends in the neighborhood and met, you know, my neighbors and fellow homeowners. And the average house down there is like 135 years old. So they all have stories, and people began telling me about their ghostly antics in their houses. And some of them knew about scandals and murders that had taken place on the premises. Some of them had family legends that were passed on. And I was amazed when I moved to that part of the city, when I moved to Louisville, actually, that the city wasn't doing more to promote the neighborhood kind of as a tourist attraction. So I began writing these stories down using the ghost stories and the legends as a way to talk about more than just the supernatural. You know, I always tell people, you don't need to believe in ghosts to enjoy a good ghost story. There's history, there's architecture, there's real life characters and the local flavor. So I began writing books about the ghostly goings on in the neighborhood. At the time, I was actually a food writer, so I was working on my first cookbook in the house. And so I started writing about Kentucky things and especially old Louisville. And people, they began wanting more of my books. And so I kept writing, and then they wanted to see the places that they were reading about. So we started a tour company, and we give walking tours of the neighborhood. But I moved out of that house in 2008, and I was looking for a different place. And right around the corner from where I was living on 3rd Street, I heard the Richard Robinson house had come on the mansion. The Richard Robinson house was huge. It was twice the size of my house, more than twice the size. It had 12 bedrooms. It was over 10,000 square feet. But I heard they had the original wine cellar from when the family built it in 1898. And I got into my head that I wanted a wine cellar. And so I made a point.
Because we all need one at one point in our lives, right?
Yeah. And so I made an appointment with the real estate agent, and I went and looked at the house, and it was just it was a mess, you know. The house I had lived in for the previous 8 years, it needed some work, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a major project. It was decorating and minor repairs and things like that. But this house was in really bad shape. The kitchen looked like it had been bombed out. The carriage house was falling apart in the back alley. There were still a lot of beautiful fixtures, like the grand stairs and stained glass windows and fireplace mantles and molding and beautiful hardwood floors throughout the house, but it just needed a lot of work. And so I could tell kind of right away when I went, and it was probably going to be too big of a project for me to complete. So I was already deciding probably I wouldn't buy the house, but I wanted to go see the wine cellar before I, you know, said no for sure.
Right.
So I went down to the basement. It was like a maze-like warren of rooms. And the wine cellar was a corner room. It was one of two rooms in the basement that still had a dirt floor. And you could barely tell it was a wine cellar. You could see like the outlines of shelves that had been on the wall. Previous tenants had, they had thrown in boxes of, you know, junk and stuff. And it was just a mess. So I said, no, thank you. And I left, and I was leaving the front steps, I was going down to the sidewalk, and a man rushed up the steps past me, kind of almost bumped into me and didn't even, you know, acknowledge me, didn't even say excuse me. And he had the appointment with the agent right after I did. And I didn't really think anything of it until 2 years later. It was the morning of June 18th, 2010. I was watching TV and drinking my morning coffee before I went off to teach. I teach at a local university here. And all of a sudden, a news flash popped on the screen, and this familiar-looking house popped up, a big, boxy, red brick house. And then a mugshot popped up. And I thought, he looks familiar. Who is that? And then they put a name up. They identified the guy in the mugshot as Jeffrey Munt. And all of a sudden, pieces started to fall into place. It was the house I had looked at. Jeffrey Munt was the guy who had the appointment with the real estate agent that morning. I looked at it. So I said no. He said yes. And he's a Louisville guy. He had just moved back from Chicago, though. And the night before, so the evening of June 17, 2010, around 9:30 in the evening, police received a call from 911. And it was Jeffrey Munt, who was calling from 1435 South 4th Street. He was barricaded in a bedroom on the second floor because he said his boyfriend, another local guy who had just moved back from Chicago, his name is Joseph Banas, locals call him Joey. He's from a very prominent family here in town, but unfortunately he was like the black sheep of the family and had drug issues and had been to prison and things. But Jeffrey and Joey, they met on an internet hookup site and they started dating, and Joey had moved himself into the house, and they had been living together for a while. But that evening, Jeffrey Munt called and told the police to come because Joey was trying to murder him. He was out in the hallway with a hammer, banging on the wooden door, trying to come inside and kill him. So the police responded. They arrested Joey Banas. It was looking like he was trying to flee the house as right as they arrived, but they caught him and arrested him. And then, as they do, they took the two parties aside, and one officer questioned each of them to kind of get their version of events. And that's when they began hearing grumblings about somebody knowing something where a dead body was buried. And they didn't take it seriously at first. They said a lot of times when you arrest people, you know, they'll make things up and try to bargain and, you know, leverage the situation. But Joey Banas kept talking, and he said he knew where the body of a guy named Jamie Carroll was. It was a guy from Eastern Kentucky. He said he's been dead for 7 months and people don't even know he's missing yet. They still didn't believe him, but reluctantly, a detective decided to call around and just double check to make sure. And he started calling, and within an hour or two, they found out, sure enough, a guy named Jamie Carroll from the eastern part of the state had been missing for 7 months. And that's when they realized that Joey Banas knew something. And so they interrogated him all night long, and after a kind of cat and mouse game, he finally broke down and told them where the body was. And guess where the body was?
In the wine cellar.
In the wine cellar.
Now, I have to ask before we get deeper, how long after you looked at this house and they bought the house, or he bought the house, and then the body was just, or the phone call that led to the body, how long, what kind of time frame are we talking?
Not even 2 years.
Okay.
So it was fall of 2008 when we looked at the house. He was kind of slowly moving himself in. And then it was the next year, I believe, that he met Joey Banas and he moved in. So it wasn't even 2 years from when I looked at the house and when the murder made the news.
And now, so had they done anything with the house? Like, you know, fixed it up or anything like along those lines?
Yeah, they had started. Jeffrey, the plan was, I heard, he was going to turn it into a bed and breakfast. And he had restored a house before, and so he knew some things. But that evening when the police showed up and heard about the body, A&E was in town, a show called The First 48, you know, was following the Louisville police around.
Absolutely. So they used to film in Cleveland all the time.
Yeah, it's been on a number of true crime shows. But Joey Banas told the police that Jamie Carroll had been killed the previous year, and for the The last 7 months, he had been buried in the dirt floor of the wine cellar. So the police rushed. They got a search warrant because Joey said they had workers scheduled to come over that week and concrete it all over. And maybe that very next day, he said. And so the police rushed. They got a search warrant. They came back and they started to dig. And sure enough, 4 feet below the surface of the earth, they dug out a blue Rubbermaid container. And in it were the remains of Jamie Carroll. He had been shot and stabbed. They used a sledgehammer to fit his body inside. And so they were both arrested, Joey and Jeffrey, and they were charged with murder. And eventually both admitted to covering up the crime and, you know, hiding the body. But they both insisted the other had actually done the killing. And so 3 years later, 2013, we had the most scandalous murder trials Louisville had seen in a long time. They called it the trial of he said, because they both pointed the finger at each other.
I was just gonna, I was just thinking the same exact thing, the he said, yeah. He said.
And they both had separate trials, and in exchange for the prosecution dropping the death penalty as an option, they both agreed to testify against the other. And the prosecutor was a local woman named Ryan Conroy. And her argument, her reasoning for this grisly murder of Jamie Carroll was basically, it was the guys, their just general greed and depravity, their frenzied drug use. It turns out Jamie Carroll, among other things, was the guy's drug dealer. And so the night in question, he had shown up in town. He was living and working in Lexington, about an hour and a half and 15 minutes away from Louisville. And he had shown up in town planning on turning himself in the next day to the Louisville authorities because he had some outstanding warrants. And the plan was he was going to go to prison and do his time and try to come out and be on the straight and narrow. But before he turned himself in, he wanted one last night out on the town. And he had been romantically involved with the two guys. They knew he was in town and they said, "Well, come on over and bring lots of drugs and we'll party with you. We'll send you off with a bang." And Jamie came and he had lots of crystal meth. So they did drugs and other things all night. And as things were kind of winding down, that's the when the prosecution argued that the guy saw that Jamie Carroll had thousands of dollars in cash with him from his previous drug deals that day. And they concocted this scheme to kill him, keep his drugs and money, you know, that would keep them going for a couple months. Because Jeffrey Munt, he had been working right down the road at the University of Louisville. He was working as an IT consultant, and he was making like over $250,000 a year. But he began showing up high and missing work, and so they had to let him go so no money was coming in to pay any of the bills. And so they were going to use Jamie's drugs and money to kind of keep them going for a couple months. They knew he was going to turn himself in and go to jail the next day. So they were thinking people won't miss him. And Jamie Carroll, anyway, was the kind of person he'd go for months on end without talking to his own family and friends.
So disappearing wouldn't have been a big deal.
Yeah. And the sad thing is, had the guy shut up about it, they would have gotten away with murder because nobody knew Jamie Carroll was missing. When he didn't show up to court the next day, they didn't put out a bench warrant, which is standard procedure. You know, you get the person in the system. Well, they dropped the ball. So nobody knew that he never showed up for his court date. His own mother didn't even know he was missing until the night of the 911 call. So had they shut up about it, the floor would have been concreted over. And who knows if that body ever would have been found.
Well, as we know with conspiracies, it's harder to keep one. You know,
yeah.
If one person knows, it's one thing, but if two people know, well, that just jeopardized your whole situation.
Yeah, exactly. And so when the trials began, public sentiment kind of came down on the side of Jeffrey Munt. You know, he was this geeky IT guy. He had never had trouble with the law until he met Joey. Joey, on the other hand, had been to federal prison numerous times. They flew in witnesses who testified that they had seen him chase guys down the sidewalks in broad daylight with hunting knives, threatening to slash their throats in public. So
over
he was
no, what?
Different things. He used to bartend, and he claimed to have been part owner of a club. If people didn't tip him enough, he'd get mad. He would run credit card scams, you know, you'd go to the bar where he tended, and you'd have a $60 tab at the end of the night. The next day, you'd have $360 on your credit card statement. He would cheat people, and then if they called him out on it, then he'd, you know, get mad and threaten to kill them and stuff. So
basically, he was a bully.
Oh yeah, he was psychotic. And but in the courtroom, he came across as very articulate and very even keeled. He never changed his story. It was kind of fascinating to see him on the stand. But so not surprising, when the verdicts came down, people weren't surprised that Joey Banas was convicted of all the major counts. He got off on two of the minor counts, but, you know, the big ones, murder and such, he was convicted of. And he's in a prison outside of Louisville today. He got 25 to life. So he's not even halfway through his time before he can get parole. More surprising was that Jeffrey Munt was acquitted of all but two minor charges. And he only got 8 years for his part. And he was out on parole in 2014. And the reason I say surprising is because by that point, Jeffrey Munt had been caught in some big lies on the witness stand. And people began saying, you know, he sounds like the mastermind behind this all. He sounds like the one getting away with murder. And I tended to agree with that because I was in the courtroom every day of those trials doing research for the book that would take me over 10 years to write.
Because obviously I have to ask the question, what kind of inconsistencies you would think of somebody this smart would be prepared for court? But I could see how the jurors see this smart individual and they see this, you know, common criminal. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, they both were very articulate and came across as very intelligent, and they both came from upstanding families, you know. Who knows what the jury really thought when they saw both of them. But one of the inconsistencies was they brought in a witness who was someone that worked with Jeffrey Munt at the university where he was the IT consultant. She was like in the main reception area. He saw her every day for like 7 or 8 months nonstop. He invited her out to lunch and things, and she called a tip line when the murder was uncovered because she started to make some connections. And so they brought her on the stand, and she kind of gave her account of what she knew and why she suspected Jeffrey Munt. He had scratches on his neck, and she kind of, with the timeline, she figured out that was about the time Jamie Carroll was murdered. But they put Jeffrey Munt on the stand, and he said he never had met her, he didn't know her, you know, so things like that. It was obvious he knew her. And there were other situations where it was obvious he was lying. But so he, you know, in 2014, he was out on parole, and no one's quite sure where he is today. I've heard different things through the grapevine. But the weird thing is after the trial ended, and the trial itself was fascinating, just the courtroom drama, even today trying to figure out if the prosecution had it right, that they colluded, they killed Jamie Carroll together. If that's true, we don't know, or whether or not it was one that did the killing and the other one was kind of swept up in it all. There's just so many weird angles to the case. But after the trials ended, that's when all the really good stuff came out, because it turns out the house itself, the Richard Robinson house at 1435 South 4th Street, it kind of had a sinister reputation since the 1920s. It was known as a haunted house because of strange things that had gone on there. Of course, if you're an old Victorian house, you have to be a sanatorium at some time in your history, right? So in the 30s and 40s, there was a guy named Dr. Bandine. He was promising to cure people of cancer, but he was a snake oil salesman, and all these people were coming to him for treatment, you know, in high hopes and in droves, and they were dying and suffering under his care, and he had terrible bedside manner. He loved to tell his patients they were going to die to get a reaction out of them. And yeah,
I mean, geez, that's a little unethical.
Yeah, and he was brought up on ethics charges and ruined in the end because of this. And he was, besides being a snake oil salesman, he was grossly overcharging people for these worthless shots. And he was even accused of killing his last two patients outright. So from that point forward, the house kind of took on a reputation as being a destroyer of lives, because every 3 or 4 years, whoever moved in, it seemed like the house would claim another victim. There'd be financial ruin or a catastrophic illness or a deadly accident. Every 3 or 4 years, it went on that way until the 1960s. That's when a young nurse named Pauline Boren moved in, and she managed to break the curse for a time. She was there for like over 20 years until one night, a guy she was renting a room to went berserk and savagely attacked her. And he beat her so severely, it took 2 months, but she died of her injuries at a local nursing home. And so then the house sat largely vacant for the next 10 years until Jeffrey Mundt bought it.
And you were looking at to buy this house.
Yeah, yeah. I had the appointment right before him.
Knowing this stuff. You knew all this stuff.
No, but I didn't know this at the time.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
So the first time I looked at it, this wasn't known.
I was going to say, man, you are...
But I did look at it a second time knowing this and thought about buying it because after the guys were arrested, you know, the bank kind of took the house and it was listed for $119,000.
No.
And that's what it sold for eventually. Oh. And I was so tempted. I don't know.
Their book never have gotten done.
I know. Well, one night, not too long after the murder, I snuck into the house because the side door was wide open. And I went down to the basement, found the room where Jamie Carroll had been buried. And then I kind of obsessed about the house for the next 2 months. But then I woke up in my current house one night and I thought, oh, if I were waking up in that house at 3:30 in the morning and, you know, knowing that a person had been buried, you know, in the basement right below me, I realized I'd get kind of freaked out. So that's when I decided, no, I don't think I'll buy that house, even if it's a bargain basement price. But
no pun intended. So,
yeah. So the house just has a spooky history itself. And then Joey and Jeffrey had a lot more going on than just a body in their basement. That little corner room, that wine cellar, when the sanatorium was there, that was the morgue. They were storing bodies down there. And doing my research, I met some of the police and detectives involved, and one of them gave me some good evidence that there was a cult meeting down there for a time. And a friend of mine, he showed me a document from the Vatican that showed an exorcism had taken place down there. There was this weird Catholic cult meeting. And Pauline Boren, her daughter, said, in her later years, she was just a very trusting soul, and she would rent out rooms, you know, to anybody. It was a drug dealer she had rented a room to, supposedly, that attacked her and killed her. But when she was older, you know, she was kind of frail, and the house was falling down around her. And had she been a little more mobile, she probably would have had a heart attack had she gone down to the basement where that little wine cellar room was, because the guy she was renting the space to had an S&M club going down there for like a year and a half. And supposedly Joey and Jeffrey were trying to revive the S&M club days and had some parties down there. And
how big is this room?
It's not that big. I mean, they couldn't have had too many people, you know, maybe a dozen or something. Wow. Maybe they wanted people to be close together. But they found a picture from one of Jeffrey's online dating profiles of him in a full body black rubber suit. That was like his preferred attire at these parties. And that's when they started noticing comparisons between the murder of Jamie Carroll and what was happening at the Richard Robinson house with the murder house. American Horror Story was in its first season, and that was on TV. And people started noticing all these weird coincidences between the two stories, and they started calling the house Kentucky's American Horror Story House. So, yeah, and turns out Louisville has a thriving S&M scene, underground S&M scene. I learned a lot about that, talking to people and stuff. But Jamie Carroll, so he was their drug dealer, but he was also their sometimes boyfriend. And Jamie Carroll was also a well-known drag queen. When he wasn't Jamie Carroll, he was Ronica Reed, the pageant queen, He had won Miss Gay Pride, West Virginia, the year before he was murdered. So you throw a drag queen in, the story's got it all, you know.
Yeah.
But the icing on the cake is Joey and Jeffrey also were counterfeiters. And up on their second floor, they had an operation where they were taking dollar bills, they were bleaching them in chemicals and then restamping them as $50 and $100 bills. And in April of 2010, so this is while Jamie Carroll's body was in the basement, the guys went up to Chicago. They checked into the Hyatt Regency on Wacker for what I assume was going to be a test run weekend, because they wanted to see how good they were, how much fake money they could pass. And evidently they weren't very good, because they didn't even make it out of the hotel before they were arrested. They had given the doorman a fake $100, and he said he knew right away because it was still damp. It didn't feel right. And, you know, they were high all the time, so they weren't paying attention to the little details, I imagine. But the police came and arrested them, and then they raided their rooms. And in the room, they found $54,000 in counterfeit money, in addition to bags and bags of date rape drugs, bomb-making supplies, guns, forged documents, and fake identities.
What the hell were these guys? I mean, this is the convenience store of terror.
Yeah. So supposedly they were going to do a bank heist while they were in Chicago, because Joey had connections from his prison days in Chicago with organized crime, and he had robbed a bank in Louisville. And so they were going to kind of kill two birds with one stone. But all the forged documents and the fake ID stuff kind of ties into another whole bizarre angle of the case. And that is when Joey Banas took the stand. They both claimed to have been living in fear of the other for the 7 months that they had been living in the house. And they were afraid that the other was going to go kill their pets and their family. And both claimed to have been living in terror of the other. Well, Joey, he said his reason was especially valid because Jeffrey Munt had told him that he had worked as an assassin for the CIA and had killed over 30 people for them. And when that came out in court, when people just kind of rolled their eyes, because Jeffrey Munt is kind of geeky IT kind of guy. And when he got on the stand, he said that was only role play. They like to do sexual role plays, and that was his character as a role play. Joey Banas insisted no, he had told him about certain assassinations he had carried out and even showed him newspaper articles. And the funny thing is, we found out later that Jeffrey Munt is an expert in Eastern European history and culture, and he speaks several Eastern European languages. And that kind of sounds kind of like CIA kind of stuff, doesn't it?
A little bit.
One news outlet here did a brief story about the supposed CIA connection, but then the next day the story was down and no one ever really talked about it. And when Jeffrey Munt was released on parole in 2014, they arrested him right away and they took him up to Chicago, because when the guys were arrested for the murder, they'd been arrested for the counterfeit money charges, you know. And so they took him up to Chicago, supposedly for that trial, and the fact that he had forged documents and other fake things. And so I called around, I tried to find out where his trial was, and it took me 2 weeks before I finally found a helpful clerk who was able to find him in the system. And she stayed on the phone with me for an hour and said, yeah, it's going to be at the Cook County courthouse, but they keep moving this around and they keep giving it different judges, and then another judge takes over. And so she finally, this was the day before the trial was supposed to happen, she finally said, okay, it's courtroom so-and-so, and she gave me the address and the exact time the trial was supposed to happen, and the courtroom number. And so I drove up to Chicago and went to the Cook County courthouse, and I found the courtroom, and there was no Jeffrey Munt there. He wasn't even on the docket, you know, the listing of trials that were going to take place. And I went through the whole courthouse looking at all the dockets, and there was no mention of Jeffrey Munt anywhere. So nobody knows whatever happened with that.
And so that was the last of what we've heard of him?
Yeah. Someone, the word is on the street is he changed his name and went to Europe and is working under an assumed identity. In the meantime, I've been told, no, that's not true. I can't make any official announcements, but you might be seeing my book or one of my recent books on the screen pretty soon, because Hollywood has heard about it, and it's a really interesting story. And some people are doing some investigating, and they think they've tracked him down, but they won't tell me where he is.
Interesting. I was going to say, where are the producers knocking on your door anyway for this story? Because this is it reminds me of
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Exactly.
That was my intent all along. I didn't shy away from that. And I even thank John Berendt in the book. You know, I remember when I was reading Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, I was living in my house on 3rd Street, and I kind of stopped and I looked around and I thought, oh, Louisville has all this. We got weird people and drag queens all over the place, and we got old mansions and old money and nouveau riche, and we got lots of eccentrics. And
just like Savannah.
So I always strove to kind of capture the quirky bits about the city, and that's kind of the title kind of pays homage to that. The book is called A Dark Room in Glitterball City.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
A lot of quirky little claims to fame. And one of them is they call us Happy Birthday City because sisters Patty and Mildred Hill wrote the Happy Birthday song here in 1893. So this is the birthplace of the most sung song in the English language. It's also where, back at the height of the world's disco craze in the 70s and 80s, all the disco balls were coming from. And the company is still around today. It's called Omega National Products. And they...
kudos for them for surviving the disco ball era.
Back then, they had a crew of like 25 women who cranked them out, each by hand. Each of them made like at least 20 a day. Of those, there's only one left, though. Her name's Yolanda Baker, and she's something of a local legend. She's known as the reigning queen of disco balls. And the last handmaker of disco balls in the world left, is what they say. But she's getting ready to retire, and she doesn't make as many as she used to. She makes like 6 or 7 a week now. That's a lot, because by the mid-90s, China had overtaken with mass production. You know, so Louisville doesn't make the most anymore, but Louisville, the company, is still around. And all the iconic disco balls you've probably seen on TV and in the movies, those are Louisville disco balls. That's what John Travolta was dancing under in Saturday Night Fever.
Right.
If anyone's old enough like me to remember Soul Train, Don Cornelius, he had that huge one. That was like their most famous one back in the day. But it's not surprising a Louisville company would have this tradition, because it was a Kentuckian in 1917 already who first patented something called the Myriad Reflector. That was the early disco ball. And throughout the decades, they've called it a glitter ball. That name sticks around here a lot. Omega National Products officially calls theirs a mirror ball, but most people know it as a disco ball. So Glitter Ball City, that's another one of our quirky little nicknames or one of our claims to fame. And people have really been embracing the disco ball craze lately. A lot of Louisvillians, like, you're not a real Louisvillian if you don't have a Omega National Products mirror ball, you know, in your house.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How do you go about, this is just a little bit about the craft. I mean, like, when you're exploring, you know, the ins and outs of old Louisville, and you're trying to get the, you know, like you mentioned, the mystique and sort of the unique characters, you know, who is it that you first go to when you start that research?
So, you know, this book was different. You know, this is my first, like, true crime book. And
okay.
So my first line of defense was doing the research by sitting in the trials, being in the courtroom, and observing and taking notes and trying to, you know, formulate an opinion. And so within a couple of years, I realized I wasn't just going to take the true crime approach, straight true crime approach. I realized I could include some of my personal history and information, you know, my process as a writer, and I could bring in colorful characters from the neighborhood and all the quirky things about the city. And it took me so long to write, partially because, you know, I got into my head that I needed to be able to talk to Joey and Jeffrey, the accused killers, and get their version of events before I could finish the story. And they refused to talk to me. And so about 7 or 8 years in, you know, I realized they weren't going to talk to me, and I would just have to build that into the story. And so it was those last 2 or 3 years, that's when I really got to work. I obtained the courtroom tapes, because Kentucky tapes all their trials, and I watched everything and compared my notes, you know, saw some things I had gotten wrong, and then I transcribed a lot of it myself. So a big chunk of my process was watching the trials and recreating the courtroom scenes that were most pivotal. And then the good thing about obtaining like the transcripts and the tapes after the fact, when you get the tapes after the trial has ended, you get all the extra stuff that you don't get to see if you're, you know, in the audience in the courtroom. For example, anytime the prosecution objects and the defense and the prosecution have to go talk to the judge at the bench and he hits a button and the courtroom is filled with white noise, you get to hear all the stuff that they were talking about after the fact. You also get to see the voir dire, them questioning the jurors and how the jurors were kind of weeded out and stuff. And you get all the pretrial motions that the public wasn't allowed to see. So I got to see a lot of interesting things that didn't come out during my sitting through the trials themselves. So that took a big chunk of work. But when I realized that Joey and Jeffrey weren't going to talk to me, by that time, enough distance had, you know, come between the murder and where I was at that point in my life that I was able to kind of look back and put kind of a memoir twist to the story. So I was able, especially during the pandemic, I was able to use that time to kind of look back and reflect on things. And so the book has a prologue and an epilogue, and both of those involve me looking at the house and considering buying it. But in the epilogue, I'm able to update people on what happened since the trials ended, and a lot of the characters in the book, what happened to them and things like that. So it was an interesting process. So this is a true crime book, but it's a memoir as well, because I was kind of directly involved in some form or other.
And it covered so many years of your life. I mean, it is. Yeah. And did you by chance interview anybody that went to their S&M club in the basement?
I had people approach me and tell me that they had been to certain parties there. Some of the stuff I heard was kind of dubious, that like the timeline wasn't matching up. Some people, you know, they wanted attention. And I was like, well, Joey and Jeffrey weren't even together then. He wasn't in Louisville then. So I had to weed out
some stuff. Insert themselves into the story.
Yeah, I had to weed out some stuff. But yeah, a couple people said they had been at some of their parties. And yeah, of course, when the book came out, then of course, a lot of people got in touch with me, like with the really good information, you know, that I could have used during the book, you know.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah. So I could probably write a second book. Like, I just saw the news.
I was going to say, where's the sequel?
Yeah.
And like, for example, you know, the book is published and you receive a phone call. Like, what kind of information are we talking about here? Like, just weird stuff that
weird
happened
stuff,
within the
like,
house?
Or like Jeffrey Munt, he was an odd character. He He liked to feign a British accent. A lot of people thought he was British. Like he was in charge of this big IT project at Northwestern University in Chicago. That's kind of where he made a big name for himself. And for example, one of his coworkers got in touch, and she said that they thought he was British. Like for the first 6 months, they knew him because he would like use a fake British accent. And when I had seen him in town, he would always. I would run into him like at a local breakfast place, and he'd say, "Top of the morning to you." You know, he was so cheesy. And so then people started getting.
Did he carry an umbrella as well?
Yeah, sometimes he did. And so someone, they said they had been at a, they had all gone to a conference together, and they talked about how demeaning he was to like the parking lot attendant because she had messed up his change. And Jeffrey thought he was smarter than everyone else, and one of his coworkers said that he would only accept, like, because he was like the main guy in the department, and people had to submit reports. He would only accept things in a certain font and 14-point size and stuff. If it wasn't that way, he'd throw it back at them and have fits. And he had cats, but he named all his cats and his pets after Charles Dickens characters, primarily from the Pickwick Papers. And if people were smart enough to know that he had named his pets after Dickens characters, they were good enough to be his friends and for him to hang out with. If they didn't get that connection, then they were beneath him. So just weird little things like that, you know, idiosyncrasies.
And so that makes me wonder, you know, what in the hell the attraction was between Jeffrey and Joey.
Well, supposedly, and this is another thing where we found out that Jeffrey had lied. So his defense, which was very successful, he had a great defense team. They painted him as a victim, and they were able to show that Joey Bannis had kind of picked him as a mark and had a plan, you know, to seduce him and use him. And he had a GPS tracker installed on the car so he could watch where Jeffrey was going and stuff. And all kinds of stuff came out about Joey Bannis. But supposedly Jeffrey Munt had just been in a long-term relationship, and his boyfriend broke up with him by text. And so he had come back to Louisville to kind of lick his wounds. That's what the defense said. That's what Jeffrey said. Well, one of his coworkers at Northwestern said, "That's not the case. Michael never did that." They said Jeffrey Munt tried to do a power grab in his department and demanded more money, and they told him no, so he kind of left town with his tail between his legs. He was embarrassed. And so there was a thing where he got caught in a lie. But supposedly, you know, he was attracted to Joey, who was his bad boy. And he said at first he was attracted because he was very articulate and he could talk about literature and stuff, and he had a good sense of humor. So he said at first he was very attracted to him, but then he said he slowly kind of saw the psychotic side of him.
Now, did this information come out throughout the court hearings?
Which?
Or did he actually, like as far as like the information about Jeffrey and his own personal feelings about Joey, I mean, did he actually provide interviews at all to any reporters throughout any of this, or has he been just like a, you know, a closed box since he was arrested?
Yeah, he has not been interviewed on the news or anything, but what happened is the night that they were both arrested and interrogated, they recorded all of this. So we have those tapes. And in addition, we have all the footage from the First 48 program. Their camera crew filmed it all as well. So there's the actual tapes of the interrogation, and then there's the First 48 information as well. And that's where we find out more about his feelings about Joey.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the First 48 stuff because like we just briefly touched on it. And so they were there filming as they typically do. They usually put producers in a hotel, and you know, when something comes in, they're usually on the scene pretty quickly. Was this one of those episodes where they were actually called to the scene?
Yeah, they were. They were. Wow. I think they had just gotten in town. And the thing is, a lot of time, if you watch the first 48, there's certain cities that pop up all the time. And so Louisville pops up all the time. And people are like, what the hell's going on in Louisville? Are you guys crazy? Well, there's
same with Dallas.
Yeah.
Same with Cleveland.
Well, there's certain cities that have contracts with them. You know, they get paid to do it. So it's not just that cities are doing it for nothing. They're doing it because they're getting something out of it.
Crime riddled as badly as they portray.
Yeah, so it's Louisville is just one of the cities that has a contract with them. And they had a pretty established relationship with a well-known detective who ended up being the lead detective in this case. And so because he was called in the first 48, they were alerted and their camera was there when they went to dig out the body.
That's just one of those serendipitous production moments where you're like, wow, we are just sort of in the right place at the right time.
What are the chances?
Yeah. Exactly right. And you said it took you 10 years to write this book.
Yeah.
I mean, just from beginning to end. And I mean, that must have been quite the process. And you've written a number of books, though. I mean,
yeah.
Was this the hardest book that you've ever written,
yes.
you think?
Yeah, this was book number 13, and I'm hoping it's lucky number 13. It's actually doing pretty well. It's already in its second hardcover printing, and the paperback is
That's
coming
great.
Out in the spring. So it's doing pretty well. But yeah, this was definitely a big chunk of my life, and it took an emotional toll, you know, because I was getting some pushback. Some people didn't like the fact that I was kind of exposing the soft underbelly of the neighborhood. And, you know, whenever real people are involved, you're gonna piss some people off. And so I had some people angry at me. And there were times where I had to just put the project on the back burner. You know, there were times where 6 months went by and I just, you know, I couldn't do it because it was getting so stressful. And especially as I was finding out details about the murder and stuff. And there was a 6 month period where the stress was just so bad. I was grinding my teeth so severely at night. My teeth were breaking. I went to the dentist and all my back molars were broken.
He's like, you need a night guard.
Yeah. And my jaws would lock in the middle of the night. And it was just, stress of, you know, the book and the information I was uncovering. And then the people I had to deal with, you know. So I tried to employ a certain journalistic approach, you know, and how I covered the trial and stuff. But then there's, you know, real life characters in the neighborhood. And so I played around with that a bit just to make it more interesting. But
give me an example of a character in old Louisville that really stands out to you.
Well, when you read the book, there's everyone's favorite character is a character named Candy. And I met Candy years ago in my previous book, which is called Voodoo Days at La Casa Fabulosa. It's kind of a memoir about that haunted house I lived in, that's a supposedly haunted house. And it was about the first year when all the weird things happened. And what I discovered is, I had spooky stuff happen in the house, but it was the real life characters in the neighborhood that were the fascinating things, I thought. And so one night I was out walking my dog and there was this little neighborhood cemetery, and I went and sat on a bench, and a voice startled me out of the blue. Someone was sitting on a nearby bench smoking a cigarette, and a person introduced themselves as Candy. And it turns out he lived in a nearby bungalow, but his name was Randy, actually. But when his wife went to bed, he liked to put on her clothes and go walk around the neighborhood. And when he was dressed as a woman, he liked to be called Candy. And so I met her. I only saw Candy ever dressed as a woman. I don't know what he looked like as a man. I might have met him as a man. I didn't know about it. But I only ran into Candy when she was dressed as a woman. And so I had written this scene in my previous book, and then remember how I said I snuck into the house to see the basement,
yes,
where Jamie Carroll was buried. Well, I snuck down there, and like I said, it was a maze-like Warren of rooms, and I snuck down there. I found the room where the pit was, and all of a sudden, I smelled cigarette smoke, and a voice said, "Well, fancy meeting you here." Guess who it was? Candy.
Candy.
Like 10 years since I had last seen her. She was half the neighborhood was going into the house to see the burial pit where Jamie Carroll had been.
I was going to say, are you sure she's not a ghost?
I know. I mean, you can't, you know, she's just too good a character to make up. But it turns out Candy belonged to this, what they call urban explorer group, you know, where they go into abandoned buildings and factories and stuff, places that are off limits. And so she loved to sneak into, you know, abandoned houses and buildings and stuff. And so I just ran into her that night and she almost gave me a heart attack. Well, then I would, I ran into her several more times throughout the course of me writing the book and stuff. And so she is everyone's favorite character. I mean, it turns out she had some involvement in the local S&M scene and shared some interesting stuff with me and was just kind of an interesting character. And I told people if this ever gets, I told my agent if this ever, you know, ends up being made into a movie, I get to play the Candy part. That'll be in my contract because Candy looked like a man in a dress. Candy was not like an elegant, like drag queen female
creator. Didn't go through the like the full, like
a man,
you know,
in a dress, and I will look like a man in a dress.
Like, hey, my wife just went to bed. Let me throw on her clothes and go outside.
Yeah, and so, yeah, he always called it that old banshee, and. And then, like, later on, I'd run into her more and more because he said, that old banshee started taking melatonin, and now she snores like a Nazi. I can go out anytime I want and wear whatever clothes I want and stuff. And I met her once when the old banshee was out in Arizona visiting some relatives. So he had 2 weeks all by himself. And I ran into him at a local diner, and he had kind of like an Audrey Hepburn style dress on, like a sheath dress, and he had blue eyeshadow, and he had done some makeup, and he actually looked pretty, you know, pretty done up compared to the previous times I had seen him. But yeah, that is probably the most popular character in the book, Candy, the neighborhood.
So basically, Candy. It sounds like Candy just. It's like a it's no big deal. It's just. Yeah,
that's
just old Louisville.
And that's how old Louisville is. And, you know, some people read about some of the characters and like, that person is not real. And you can Google the person online, find out, yeah, that person is real. You know, like a good friend of mine, his thing was he just loved to wear German officer uniforms from World War II, you know, out in public. And
that's...
Yeah. And he knew he would
toeing the line.
Yeah, he would do it anyway. I mean, I showed up once when I lived in the previous house, and he was on an inner tube in our swimming pool, naked, just floating there, and his Nazi uniform had been draped over the patio table and stuff, and he had just stopped by for a visit, and his name was Kelly, and people like that guy wasn't real, and half the city knows Kelly Atkins. He was pretty well known in the restaurant scene. He was like a wine captain and a waiter at a lot of different fine dining establishments. So everybody knows him. And he was just like a natural storyteller. Half the time, you know, it was like a big fish kind of story. You know, there was usually some kind of grain of truth in his stories, but it always got blown way out of proportion. So he's another character that people did. That person does not exist. And you talk to anyone in Louisville, half the city knows him. And so, yeah, a lot of the best characters you couldn't make up.
That is so funny. Now, as we're coming to an end here, is there anything about these characters or the characters, you know, Jeffrey and Joey, that you haven't shared with us that we should know?
Well, and this is something that I strive to do in the book. I try to remind people that Jamie Carroll was the victim here and he was innocent. And this case was kind of sensational. You know, they called it the Pink Triangle murder as well because the accused killers were gay. The victim was gay. So there's a lot of homophobia that reared its ugly head during the trials. And there was a lot of victim shaming because Jamie Carroll, you know, he was a drug dealer and he had a checkered past, but you know, that doesn't justify getting murdered. So I try to include people who knew him as a human being and, you know, loved him and try to show that his death impacted a lot of people. And so I, you know, what I share about Jeffrey and Joey comes from what I found out in the courtroom or people who knew them got in touch with me and told me. But I really try to humanize Jamie Carroll and point out that he was the innocent victim here.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think that's the most important thing when you do cover a story like this, where the victim is sometimes forgotten about and because of the other details of the story. Yeah. And it's just one of those situations where it's good that you focused on him as, you know, being a victim. And again, it doesn't matter what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody deserves to be murdered.
Yeah.
And anybody who does, you know, commit murder should be held accountable. It's just as common sense.
Yeah.
And so let's say somebody would like to pick up your books. Where would they be able to find them?
Well,
your website?
Amazon.com, probably the easiest place. It's on Audible as well. But your local indie bookseller probably has them. But, yeah, it's called The Dark Room in Glitterball City. And it's out there. So just ask around. But, you know, Amazon's got them all, that's for sure.
And this was, you said your 13th book?
Yeah, this was book number 13.
All right. Well, lucky number 13 is one hell of a story.
Yeah.
And I will say that definitely some characters and the connection between Midnight and the Garden of Good and Evil is definitely there. And anybody who likes that Southern Gothic, I mm-hmm. think, is, you know, would definitely enjoy this book. And, man, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
All right, David, thank you again. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.
And that will do it for this week's episode of Who Killed. Thank you so much to David Domine for joining me to discuss his book about the killing of James Carroll, and that is titled A Dark Room in Glitterball City. And again, thank you to the listeners for joining us for this very wild tale. And again, you can pick that book up on Amazon, and it is a wild ride. If you liked Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, then you will like this book as well. And so check it out. If you guys are interested in knowing what's coming up in the future, you can follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. As well as if you're interested in donating to the show, you can do so via the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. Now, every contribution helps keep these shows running, and it doesn't hurt to leave a review. So I appreciate all the time that you guys put into listening, and as always, until next time, stay healthy and be safe.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, Stay safe out there.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.